This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. I'm Vanessa Sockett, and joining me today is HPC Dan, one of the prominent voices in our HPC community. Dan is now an officially retired professor emeritus at the University of Utah after spending 61 years in the educational system and many at Microsoft. Wow, Dan, so we are honored to have you on the show today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I think you just called me old, but I will own it because I am. But look forward to the conversation. And you're right, over 40 plus years in the technology business, a lot has changed.
Indeed. So you have a breadth of life experience that I'm interested in talking about. Actually, first, let me tell you, it was really fun to find you because we have a Dan on our team. And I was like, oh no, there's another HPC Dan out there. Actually, he was probably the first HPC Dan. How can we have two HPC Dans? How do we resolve this? But then I kind of thought about it. I was like, you know, maybe this is like HPC guru, where, what's the phrase they always say? Like, we are all HPC gurus. So like, we are all HPC Dan, except caveat, you just need to be named Dan for that particular club.
Yeah, I was, for a while when I was at Microsoft, I was MSR Dan. And before I went to Microsoft, I was Rency Dan. And after I, because I founded the Renaissance Computing Institute, and after I left Microsoft, I decided, okay, I have to change from MSR Dan to something. And I decided, why not HPC? And that's what it's been since.
I definitely like it. So we have a lot to talk about. I usually open up the show and ask about life experience. So maybe let's take a bird's eye view or, you know, a Cliff Notes version. Can you tell us, not the details, but generally how you got interested in computational science and the adventure, the high level adventure that you've been on since you started?
Well, in some sense, it probably started when I was in high school. I'm about as old as you can actually get and have a computer science degree. But when I was in high school, I spent part of a summer. I grew up in the Arkansas Ozarks, and I spent part of the summer at the University of Arkansas in a physics program. But one of the things they did, and mind you, this is the 1970s, they gave us a Fortran manual and they taught us the rudiments of programming. And because at that point, my dream was to be a physicist. I realized one of the fascinating things that one could do is you could bring all of those physics equations to life and see them dance and move in the machine that they never would do on a piece of paper. And for me, I was like, okay, I have found the path of a lifetime. And that was the beginning of a lifelong collaborations in high-performance computing and application of computing to the sciences and even the arts and humanities.
So one question and theme that I'm interested in that probably will come up many times given your experience in HPC and then sort of cloud is this view of whatever you want to call that space. And my team, we call it converged computing, but I'm sure it's had many different names over the years. Now, I don't want to say cloud versus HPC. I very specifically am saying cloud and HPC because I'd like to not see this adversarial kind of relationship between those two things. So you started in academia, and then I would suspect after some prodding, you joined Microsoft, and then you went back to academia. So just first, that kind of transition is something that many of us in academia or national labs think about a lot. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about the experiences, sort of compare and contrast and discuss the kind of impact that you're able to have from each of those places.
Well, first, I would absolutely agree with you that I think it's not a cloud versus HPC. And the other, I think, canard has been AI versus HPC. It's an and in both cases, not an or. It's really the union of all of those things. But as you said, I intended to be an academic. In graduate school, I had this crazy idea that you could build supercomputers out of large numbers of microprocessors. And that was really how I began my career. And it was a crazy idea at the time, but of course, it's the mainstream approach now. And so I had spent 20 years at the University of Illinois. I had just moved to Research Triangle Park to build a research institute that spanned UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and NC State, called the Renaissance Computing Institute. When I was approached about joining Microsoft originally to run their high-performance computing business, I said no multiple times, eventually said yes, and among other things, was privileged to be there really in the transition to multi-core processors, but then, as you mentioned, the beginning of cloud computing as Microsoft was then building what became Microsoft Azure. And I do agree it is an and, not an or. Computing is a tool. And I often tell people that, much like George Orwell's 1984, where there's revisionist history, that we often, in the midst of scientific revolutions, say, no, we'll never do that. We'll never do that. Well, of course, we've always done that. And I think that's one of the things that's happened with HPC and cloud, and it's clearly happening with HPC and AI.
So first, I'll say I have a little background in for the Research Triangle Park because of where I went to college, and I worked there. And actually, I'm not sure if you know one of my previous bosses, Ruth Marenshaw. I think she was at RENCI for a little bit of time, maybe not overlapping with when you were there, though.
Oh, I know Ruth well. In fact, she worked for me. Among other roles I had at UNC, I was the chief information officer, and Ruth worked for me in that role and then worked for me at RENCI. RENCI was actually an interesting idea and still is. The idea, I have to give credit to an artist friend of mine from Illinois when I was director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, Donna Cox, is well known for some of the early internet visualizations, but a lot of scientific visualization work as well. I was a strong proponent of this notion that you can do more with teams who bring diverse backgrounds together than any one group, any one individual or group could do together. And the days when any of us could claim to know everything worth knowing have passed centuries ago. With that notion of a Renaissance team of individuals that bring disjoint backgrounds together to do something that no one of them could do separately, I thought was a powerful idea, and I still do. And that was really the genesis of the Renaissance Computing Institute, and an idea I've tried to carry through since then in both scholarship, but also in science and technology policy.
Policy. I'm definitely going to be asking you about that. Just very quickly, what made you eventually say yes to Microsoft?
Well, first of all, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer are very persuasive individuals. And so, after declining twice, the third time, and not only the two of them, but Craig Mundie and Rick Rashid, I decided the opportunity was there. I remember talking to Rashid at one point, and he said, "What are you trying to do?" And I said, "I'm trying to address some deep societal problems in North Carolina." And he said, "Why not come to Microsoft and address them on a global stage?" And in the end, I decided that was a pretty powerful incentive. The resources available in a multinational corporation dwarfed anything that I could hope to secure from either the state or the federal government, though both have been generous in supporting my ideas over the years. It was the chance to really have a global impact that was the attraction. And I will say that that experience was confirmed. The resources and scale at which a major company can work is truly astounding. And the speed with which it can move when an issue is viewed as critical are also astounding compared to what happens in academia and in government.
Oh, that's really interesting to hear. So you mentioned policy, and I know that this year you appeared before Congress to talk about strategy for science. I also have been perusing your blog, Reed's Ruminations, and I've seen that you've done this a couple times, I think back to 2007, and there's this common theme that the government needs a coordinated strategy. And so the details are sort of different over the years. For example, now I think it's on STEM investment. Your earliest posts, at least that I found, was about 18 years ago. Can you talk us through some of these experiences over the years and how these early initiatives have shaped policy and which have been successful, which have maybe been less successful, and what your vision is for what we should be doing as a country?
Well, first, let me say that I think it is really important in a technological world for scientists and engineers to be engaged in the public discussion. So many of the issues that face us are either created by technology or the potential solutions involve science and technology that we have to be at the table, and we can't leave that to other people. Part of our role, I think, is to be educators and explain the technology. The meme of the day is AI, and to a lot of people, AI looks like threatening technological magic. Not that complicated, at least generative AI is not. It's a lot of really fast machines, digital knowledge base, and a lot of low precision linear algebra, along with some nonlinear optimization. So I got involved early on because I had mentors who helped me understand those issues. Ken Kennedy was both a friend, a collaborator, and a mentor. He was on the president's Information Technology Advisory Committee in Clinton administration, and he worked with Al Gore when Gore was vice president. So I kind of tagged along and learned from him. I wound up being on PTAC myself in later years, and then the President's Council of Science and Technology Advisors, and then most recently, I was chair of the National Science Board. But the message I've tried to preach is really twofold. As an aside, one of the things that my Arkansas parents hoped I might be was an evangelical preacher. And I like to tell people I am preaching the good news. The good news is that education is a powerful enabler of social change and economic transformation. So, a two-part message is, we have to invest in talent. Talent is no respecter of socioeconomic status. And when I ran global technology policy for Microsoft, that's one of the messages I told government ministers and heads of state around the world, that the future of your country is not just among the rich and the powerful, it is among the talented. And talent comes from everywhere, and you have to find it and cultivate it. And something I believe is true everywhere, including in the US. So, how we invest in STEM education from K-12 up through post-secondary and graduate education is critical. But I think the other, in a rapidly changing world, is it is incumbent upon us to continue to invest in the future. And that means not just government investment in academia, it means whole of society collaborations. Government, academia, national labs, private sector, nonprofits, the public all have critical roles to play in that partnership. In an increasingly globally competitive world driven by science and technology, advantage accrues to those societies that invest in their people and invest in exploring the future, because that future is what defines the future economy, defines national security, and also defines our public health.
Okay, so if we know today that, for example, you're talking about all of these different groups working together in policy, if we know today that industry is generally receiving a greater share of GDP in the United States, I'm wondering what mechanisms are in place for kind of smaller, less funded, less powerful, and more loosely aggregated sets of institutions like national labs, like academia, to get the work done that we need to get done for science. When we are really kind of the little guys and the power is wielded by industry. And the problem that I see is that the government could make laws or that mandate how resources are shared with academic institutions or something like that. But then what happens when, for example, big tech companies move their business elsewhere? Like what it, there's definitely a balance there. And so I'm wondering what kind of solutions you see viable for kind of fixing this situation, which to me appears off balance.
Well, one thing I would say about academia and national labs is don't chase what industry is doing. Break new ground, look at problems in a different way. And I was in Europe last week and I gave this speech celebrating the 50th anniversary of the University of Vienna's computer science department. And last week, it was really exciting news. A whole slew of papers highlighting the complete connectome of the fruit fly. And if you think about what we're doing now in artificial neural nets and generative AI, we're focused on large models, very high-powered computing, both in the energy sense and in the computing capability sense. Billions of dollars being thrown at those problems with good reasons. But there are alternative models of intelligence that we in academia and the national labs have not really explored. There's a lot we can learn from nature. And to me, that's a great example of be creative, think differently, explore some alternatives. And as I said to a group the other day, if I were to stand and hold out the tip of my finger and say, I have a chip on the edge of my finger that's capable of doing all the things that a fruit fly can do: vision, obstacle avoidance, walking, flight, complex maneuvers, reproduction, seeking energy sources, and it's powered by a fraction of a watt. The world would beat a path to my door. There is a lot we still have to discover. And I think when the problems become difficult, as Ernst Rutherford once said, we have no money, we must think. Now we do have money, maybe not enough, but we do have money and we have opportunities. I also think as we think about the future of high-performance computing, and I've spent a lot of time on this policy space encouraging the national labs and academia to think about different kinds of collaborations with the private sector. And that goes back to the whole of government notion that those major multinationals benefit from the talent stream that universities and national labs produce. And that vibrant economy, of course, is the ecosystem in which they sell their products. And for all the concerns about maybe that skew of private sector investment versus public sector investment, I still believe that the US is the most competitive opportunity to build the future. And as I gently said to some of my European Union friends, you might ask yourself why there are no trillion euro or trillion dollar companies that are emerging from your ecosystem, because you have plenty of talent and you have plenty of investment in the future. And it does speak to some of those regulatory issues that you mentioned.
So you are saying we need to be scrappy, recognize that we have fewer resources, but be creative and focus on different work that we can do with what we do have. Is that a very layperson summary?
Yes, I'm saying that we need to be innovative and creative. That, after all, is the primary function of curiosity-driven research, is to explore the future. And that doesn't necessarily mean, in fact, it almost certainly means not doing exactly what the private sector is doing, because by the time a company is willing to invest millions or billions of dollars, that technology is fairly mature and the risks have largely been removed. At least they're now risks worth taking. We in the research business, our job is to take risks often that the private sector can't do. And that means taking a longer term view. Because you asked earlier, one of the things I learned in the private sector is 3 years is a long time. It's a rare company that looks on an event horizon much longer than that. And those of us in the research enterprise have the opportunity to look 5, 10, 15, or even 20 years into the future, in some cases. That's the opportunity. And we have to be creative as we think about it. Will more money help? Obviously, it always does. But there is a lesson from the startup community as well. If you're a venture capitalist and you're investing in a startup, you can starve it by underinvesting it. But you can also cause it to fail by overinvesting. You want people to be scrappy and nimble and feel the need to innovate. And you need enough money to do that, but too much money de-risks that enterprise too. There's a balance in all of these things.
Makes sense. So let's say there's this possible future where everyone in industry is using GPUs for AI and making, cats dance on fashion runways and cars fly through space and all that. And because of the demand and the competition for the physical resources, let's now say that there's a supply chain issue. So one really good example with the recent hurricane in North Carolina is there's a mine called in Spruce Pines that produced a particular kind of quartz that was used for crucibles to manufacture semiconductors. And probably the mine itself is okay. I don't think it like destroyed the earth, but the facility, surrounding the mine was destroyed, and that introduced an issue in the supply chain. So given that there are possible futures where there's actual competition for like hardware, those kinds of resources between industry and then sort of the less powerful institutions that we've been talking about, that would suggest that we need to accept that GPUs are really awesome, but actually we still need to get most of our work done on CPU. Is that something you'd agree with, or do you think that GPUs are something that the labs can continue to invest in? And this is an interesting question too, because if I understand the history right, it was the labs that really pushed for and helped GPUs get out there in the first place. And it would be very ironic if, we couldn't use them in the way that we wanted to.
So, no, I wouldn't go so far as to say we are the poor and limited only to GPUs. I think I've actually been advocating that things like the Nair pilot need greater investment. Academia needs enough infrastructure to be able to do leading-edge science, but that science may or may not be the same as what's happening in the private sector. So that speaks to a whole set of related issues about access to leading edge research infrastructure. It means everything from the long tail of telescopes to, in biology, access to things like cryo EMs. It applies to GPU accelerated clusters and data archives in academia that give you enough capability to explore ideas. So I do think that is important, but that needs to be matched with investment in people to build those ideas and test them, but then transition them. I often use an example which some people may or may not agree with, which is if you want to build bridges, you should be working for a construction company. If you want to explore novel bridge designs and new materials and understand issues about their behavior, those are academic questions in civil engineering. Both sides are really important, but they're different objectives.
What do you think about the extent to which the HPC community can use the cloud? So there was at a sort of adversarial culture for a couple of years. It's gotten a lot better, and that's resulted in movements like converged computing. But it still is very challenging just to get resources. And so cloud, from the very onset, actually in one of your early posts when you're talking about EC2, on Amazon, which was a lot earlier than I remember it, although I wasn't using the cloud that early. You provided language to suggest what has become kind of a standard illusion almost, that the cloud has infinite resources. And maybe back then it actually was very easy to get what you needed because it wasn't so highly in demand. But at least today, for example, if I want an A100 on a specific cloud, it will be very hard for me to get. If I want to make a reservation to get, I don't know, 32 GPU instances, each with a GPU on a different cloud, it might take me a month and then I wind up with 11. So it's very hard to get them. And the extent to which we could actually use that for our science is also questionable because we have this idea of scale in HPC and it's huge, minimally thousands of machines, if not more. But then in cloud, they don't have that same concept of scale, at least. I'm sure internally, if you work at one of these companies, you get scaled resources, but my impression is that we don't get those scaled resources. So, understanding that we can continue to do things the way that we have traditionally done them on premises, but how do you see the HPC community best leveraging cloud? And what happens, for example, when tech companies optimize their environments for AI workloads? For example, changing the precision of chips because, well, we don't need that high precision. Like we just need a, something tiny for an AI model. And then all of a sudden the HPC climate models can't run there. So what could that possible future look like for us?
So there are a lot of things to unpack in what you just said. Let me take a few, and you may want to circle back and ask some other questions. First thing to remember is that private companies are in the money-making business. They're not in the philanthropic business. So the market follows the people with the money, and they're catering to that both internally and externally, and that's how capitalism works. It's certainly true that cloud has changed the HPC ecosystem. Probably 10 years ago, I was giving the keynote at an opening workshop at SC, and I asked the assembled audience how many people knew what a container was. And the crowd of probably 104 people raised their hand. And I said at that time, this is one of the hottest things going on in commercial computing right now. And I say all that to say, if you think about the history of what I would describe as modern HPC, say in the last 20 years or so, in the early days of compute clusters, which was the transition from entirely proprietary HPC systems, there were a couple of things that happened. One, funding agencies asked, who's actually going to support these systems? And the answer was the community in large measure, not the vendors. But an interesting thing happened. There was an entire generation, maybe two, of graduate students whose lives were consumed by building and maintaining clusters, not doing science, but by building and being HPC system administrators. Now, some of those people got great jobs in that domain, and that's a good thing. But the purpose of computing in that context was science, not infrastructure. And I think that was always been my message about cloud. The only reason you have a big computer is to do things with it. It itself is not the objective. It's an enabler for the things that you want to do. All of that is prelude to say that if we want to have beyond a transactional financial relationship with large cloud providers, we have to think in a different way. And that means a different kind of collaboration that's not based on buying cycles or depending on the philanthropy that comes from those vendors. And I did the very first deal with the National Science Foundation to make cloud services available to the academic community in the early days of Microsoft Azure because I wanted people to be exposed to the different technology model. I would say the thing I most hope people will think about cloud are really two things. One, the interesting thing about clouds is the pace of innovation that's taking place in the infrastructure. The amount of money that is driving investment in new cloud services is huge compared in many ways to what we can marshal in the national lab and the academic community. And it's those tools that enable one to build new kinds of infrastructure that free people from being infrastructure builders, not completely, but to a goodly extent themselves. That's part one. Part two goes back to different kinds of partnerships. And one of the results that we strongly advocated in the National Academy study that we put out a few years ago, or a few months ago, I should say, in response to a charge from NNSA, part of DOE. And then, when I was chair of the Office of Science Advanced Scientific Computing Advisory Committee, our group put out a similar study that had some overlapping membership. And it said the relationship with cloud providers thinking about the future of HPC has to be different because those cloud providers are driving the technology innovation now. The traditional vendors of HPC are themselves supplicants. So the Intels, the AMDs, the two and three letter computer companies, they depend for most of their revenue on those cloud providers. And it's the cloud providers, the AI hyperscalers, that are dictating what technology they design and build to the extent that the AI hyperscalers are not building the technology themselves. Because remember, in the supply chain, someone else's profit is your overhead. And any way that you can squeeze overhead out of your supply chain, you increase your profit margins. And that ability to specialize hardware at scale is one of the things that's driving the innovation in the cloud ecosystem. All of which is to say, if we in the HPC world want to think about what the future of next generation systems that support scientific research, we have to build a different kind of relationship with the cloud providers, one that engages not in a transactional basis, but that probably engages in a government direct basis. And that will probably extend at a higher political level than any government agency. It's probably Congress and White House, the hyperscaler directly, to talk about those partnerships, because those partnerships in the end are about the global ecosystem and global US competition with China. And so that combination of whole of society, private sector, government, academia, national labs, that collaboration is what allows the US ecosystem to maintain its global leadership. And that means we have to think not just in a transactional way, but in a strategic way. Now, that's a long answer to many pieces of your question, but I think it has to be a collaboration that's different than just access to resources on a project-by-project basis.
Gotcha. So I can say from where I sit, we have collaborations with several clouds that are more research and learning oriented, as opposed to like, oh, well, please give me money to run this particular experiment. I'm wondering, so this isn't something I've thought about before. In terms of impact in this strategy, me as sort of a layperson to policy, when you say that, are you saying that someone like myself should be involved in more politically involved in these conversations? And if that's the case, like how do I do that?
Well, you are, yes, people need to be more involved. But what it means is that the senior leaders in government and in the national labs need to think strategically and engage in a different way. And that, in the end, it means building political consensus in the US Congress, which today is challenging. But it also means building support in the White House. And that's where strategic engagement and partnerships on committees and talking about global competition is really important. If you look back to the end of the Second World War, Vannevar Bush, who was President Roosevelt's, what we would now call science advisor, wrote a letter to Roosevelt outlining why he believed the federal government should invest in research and in curiosity-driven research. And he outlined three reasons, and they're still the right reasons. One was national security. After all, this was the end of the Second World War, and many technological innovations had been critical to US and Allied success, certainly nuclear weapons, but radar and a whole host of technologies. So national security was one. The other was economic success. At the end of the war, there was great fear that the US and the world might slip back into another continuation of the Great Depression. So, investment in the future was a way to stimulate job growth and grow the economy. It's still true. And the third reason was to ensure the public health, basically, the welfare, longevity, and access to leading-edge healthcare that is something that's critical to any society. Those three issues, national security, global economic competitiveness, and public health, they're still the reasons why governments invest. And so, what I'm saying at a high level is the enabling technologies that are part of the 21st century economy, what some have called the industries of the future, AI is on that list, quantum in all its guises, both communication and computing, and more broadly, quantum technologies are on that list. Biotech technologies are on that list. There is a list of things that are viewed as critical to the future of the US global competitiveness and also its national security. And so that whole nation partnership that keeps those ideas laser focused, that yes, we each have collateral goals. Young scholars want to create a name for themselves and explore ideas. Companies want to be successful and make money. National labs want to advance national interests. Academia wants to pursue its own interests in education and scholarship. Those are all important, but they're collateral goals to the uber issues that I mentioned of national security, economic competitiveness, and the health and welfare of its citizens. And so all I'm saying is, as we think about these allied issues, it's important to keep the eye on those three prizes.
Understood. And do you think it would make sense? You know, a lot of us kind of exist in the silo of our particular division or across a couple, but and we receive emails about, you know, kind of what's going on at the higher level, but we very much are like ostriches with our head in a hole, kind of like, you know, focused on a very specific thing. And it sounds like it would be better to have more awareness about the entire ecosystem up to that level.
Yeah, I think it's important that one maintain awareness, and that's why the relationships matter. That's why, whatever point you are in your career, unless you're old like me, having mentors is really important. If you're older, then it's really important that you share what wisdom you hope you've accumulated over the years and introduce a new generation. I think the other one that is important is to recognize that when you talk to members of government, most of them are trying to do their best to make the world a better place. There are obviously some exceptions in every government, but most people are trying really hard to do the right thing. But they, like almost everyone else, are overworked and have to deal with a whole variety of conflicting challenges. The thing that I have found most helpful when I talk to members of government, whether staffers or senior people, is not to start with what I want, because I do have some things I want, but to start by saying, "How can I help you?" And often, how I can help you may be as simple as explaining something in lay terms that they can appreciate the significance, answering some questions, building connections to other people who may have other insights that would be helpful to them. And so you build a lot more bridges by starting by saying, "How can I help you?" And then using that as a lever to talk about some other issues. You know, I sometimes say, you know, we may believe that the government invests in us, and it does, but it invests in us as instruments of change.
I really like that. Were you an advisor on the CHIPS Act? And either way, what do you think about it?
I was involved in some of the discussions about how it would emerge, yes, as were many, many other people. Two-part answer to your question about the CHIPS and Science Act. The CHIPS part is related to a really important geopolitical issue, which is that the overwhelming majority of high-end semiconductors are produced by TSMC, and there are geopolitical risks given the threats that China has made against Taiwan. And so it's important that the US and Europe, the rest of the world in general, have a reliable supply of semiconductors. US production of high-end semiconductors is in the low teens in terms of global market share. And so there are risks associated with that. So re-onshoring as part of the CHIPS and Science is a critical issue. And it's why it's important, whatever you think about the competition among Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA, Intel needs to succeed because it is our largest source of onshore semiconductor fabrication capability, at least at the high end. What's missing from CHIPS and Science is the and science part. It is missing the investment in the innovation future that goes with access to leading-edge semiconductors. And that includes both more aggressive training of people in semiconductor space. Part of what CHIPS and Science funded as well was clean room technician people who would run foundries. That's an important, there's a shortage of those people. But there is also a dearth of domestic talent in STEM. And although I believe passionately that what has made the US successful is that we were and remain a global magnet for talent, we want the best and brightest that the planet can produce to want to come, work, and stay in the US. We also have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to enhance our domestic talent? Because if you look in so many technology and science programs, they're dominated by international students. And on the one hand, that's wonderful. But it begs the question of where are our domestic students and what do we do about that? And so there are issues about what we invest, and I'll come back to that in just a second. The other thing to understand about the STEM workforce, we tend to think about college graduates and above, there are actually more STEM jobs at the community college level, the so-called skilled technical workforce level, than there are at the bachelor's level and above. And there's a critical shortage of those people as well. So that whole ecosystem investment in talent is critical, which leads me to really the piece that I think is missing from the CHIPS and Science investment beyond investing in re-onshoring and R&D, is I've advocated strongly for a Next Generation Defense and Education Act. When the Russians launched the first satellite, Sputnik, in the 1950s, the US responded by recognizing that it was underinvesting in its people. And the first NDEA invested in STEM education from primary school all the way up through universities, and it invested in increasing the global awareness of the population. There was, for example, a lot of focus on teaching students languages other than English. We need a new generation of that, in my opinion, that will invest in building a 21st century workforce that is not only STEM literate, because understanding STEM technologies is critical to making social decisions about right, wrong, and social consensus, but also about preparing a workforce to be competitive in a world that's dominated by science and technology.
So we've been talking about the workforce and personnel and innovation, and that reminds me, you wrote in a post probably back again from before 2010 that technical innovation is defined by three pillars: talent, vision, and will. And this is your words: vision can attract talent, talent gives wings to vision, will makes visions real. And I really loved that, but I thought about it quite a bit, and I see that our current kind of incentive structure in academia, national labs, is problematic for that. And so the culture that we currently have is very driven toward a certain personality type that wants to make a name for themselves, wants to publish a lot of papers, wants to kind of be a well-known person. And what happens, even for people that don't have that personality type, actually, is that our entire routines are based around this cycle of publications and venues. Oh, the next conference coming up, the next, paper we have to get out. And it doesn't really support that more long-term kind of slower thinking, slower working on more careful, creative, possibly riskier ideas, because there's this push that I must publish these papers because that is the metric of my value. And so I see that current standard in our community being very problematic toward innovation. And to kind of add to that, this other issue that I've identified over my career, so I'm someone that likes to build things. I was one of the original Singularity developers. I love building infrastructure. I love actually being creative and thinking about things that don't exist yet, ways that people could do their work that no one's thought of yet. But it's very hard to fit that kind of thinking, that kind of project space into the current culture. And so I've found that I've always been kind of different, and I've always had to figure out how to get sort of my work justified. This is a different topic, but the RSE movement happened years ago, at least in the United States. It started as early as like 2012 in the UK. In the US, it was more like 2018, 2019. And that movement is focused on research software, but in my mind, there's still this entire layer of missing infrastructure engineers. So, for example, folks that are wanting to innovate on the level of the systems, and maybe not with the goal of like, I want to publish all the papers, but the goal of like, I want to change the way that we do things. So I want to that was probably a lot, but I want to ask your thoughts on what I just said.
Well, let's start with the question of reward metrics. Your comments about the tripart structure, I still believe that. What I would say at a high level, that I worry about as a country is the missing piece, which is will. We have plenty of resources in the grand scheme, or the ability to allocate the resources, but our divisions have often created an inability to marshal shared will. To your other question about reward metrics in the small, Yes, I do think we tend to focus on excessively on incrementalism. I'll say that one of the things that I've observed that is an artifact of limited resources, and it's true the way we review proposals, it's often true the way we review papers, and it's often true the way that we think about the rewards and decision processes, is when money becomes difficult to acquire, conservatism is a result. And that may seem paradoxical, but the way that you ensure your idea gets support is by having done a bunch of the work on it already, so you can present it as a low-risk alternative. The truth is, if you want to invest in the future, you have, just like the stock market, you need to have a portfolio that has a mixture of risks. You don't bet everything on the penny stocks or the craziest startup that comes out, but some of your portfolio has to be invested in those ideas. And I would describe those ideas this way. There's some proposals that you can triage and say, no, we shouldn't do that. The large mass are ones that are in the middle. They are interesting ideas. Most of them probably won't be revolutionary, but the reason we do research is that's difficult to predict. And then there's some ideas where thoughtful, experienced people disagree violently over whether this is brilliant or foolish. Some of those ideas, you have to take a chance because those are often where the breakthroughs occur. Because conventional wisdom is divided over whether it's viable to do this or not. But the risk portfolio is really important. And as I said, when money is limited, often conservatism dominates. The broader question about rewards in terms of scholarship and publication versus building enabling infrastructure is another artifact of larger scale science. And it is important that there be career paths that are rewarding, both intellectually, but also in terms of social and financial recognition for contributions in those spaces. That's something, notwithstanding the creation of RSEs, that we still have work to do because the reward metrics for faculty or senior researchers remain quite different than those who seek to build things. Another place I would say that is challenging. You ask about my move to industry before. Most people in academia and in the national labs have never worked any place other than those places. And so their notion of what it's actually like out there in the real world is sometimes not representative of what actually happens. I've had postdocs when I've counseled them in the large when I was a VP for research about the future, that being an academic, that is the alternative career. Most people don't do that. That by definition is the alternative career. The real world out there, that's the primary career path for most people. And understanding its reward metrics and how you balance those differing views is really important.
So you probably touched on some of this, but I know that you're collaborating on a paper about the future of HPC. You probably don't want to like share all like the big points, but are there any other points from that paper that you are able and willing to share today?
We touched on many of the broad ideas, the notion of shared investment and whole of society commitments, the recognition that the nature of HPC is in flight, given the rise of hyperscalers and AI, and that government is no longer the big kid on the block in high-end infrastructure. And that means a different understanding of what the future might look like, the need to invest in talent, this need for different kinds of partnerships. The need for shared political will to invest in a future that involves deep global competition. Those are the broad themes. They're the ones that I discussed broadly. I think among many people, there's broad agreement on those. There's some disagreement on what the actions might be that would accrue from those. But a fundamental recognition that the world is changed. And maybe this is a good way to summarize that if one thinks about technological history. In the early days of supercomputing, when it was synonymous with machines that Seymour Cray built or versions of that, vector machines and multiprocessor vector machines, when the transition began to shared memory multiprocessors and then to message passing machines, there were many people who struggled to let go of the vector paradigm. The early movers who made that transition gained an intellectual advantage. We're in the midst of another transition that is just as profound, that involves both different kinds of hardware, maybe different kinds of intellectual models about the future of computing. And that goes back to that willingness to take some risks and try some different ideas, and that could build some different models. If I want to go really far back, I told a computational graduate science fellows this a couple of months ago. You know, if you think about quantum computing, pretty much everything that we do in traditional computational science is based on a multi-hundred-year-old worldview of continuous mathematics and their discretization of time-dependent PDEs, in most cases, as our computational model. That's not the only way to think about the world, but it's one that's deeply embedded in our ecosystem. Quantum models are quite different theoretically, but also how we think about them practically. And we're deeply connected to digital computing. Analog computing had a long and illustrious history, said those of us who started university using a slide rule. There are opportunities to revisit some of those issues. So as I told the graduate students, 64-bit and 128-bit floating point are not a message skies open and a deity gave to us. They're simply one number representation. They're alternative number representations that have significant advantages in some contexts. So all of those and a thousand other ideas are worth exploring. This is probably the most exciting time to be in computing and computational science in the last 20 years, because the future is really pregnant with possibilities. And so rather than just fixating on the challenges, and yes, there are challenges, the opportunities are profound. And so my word of advice, if I have any, is seize on the opportunities. My grandfather used to tell me, make new and original mistakes. Life is short. Don't make the same ones over and over again. And that's the nature of what I think research is about, trying some risky ideas and exploring the future.
I love that, and I absolutely agree. And it's really just one of the reasons that I love what I do every day when I wake up. So you tell your students that there are three enduring questions and that these questions don't change, but the answers always do. What are those questions? How do the answers change? And how do we use that for something like a life compass?
So I do believe there are three enduring questions. And I thought about that because this week the Nobel Prizes are being awarded, physics and chemistry, and today the Nobel Prize in literature. One of them is the universe, matter in the universe, and the physical processes that drive it, and the deepest questions: why is there anything at all, and how does it work, and what might its future be? The other is life and its processes, biological understanding, the ability to overcome entropy and narrow time and space, and the broad things that gave birth to life and how it works. And within that, things that are the underlying substrate for intelligence. And then overlaid on all of those, both of those questions, is the human condition. And in science and technology, we often dive deeply into one of those other two questions: matter in the universe or life and its processes. But in the end, the human condition defines how we think about the world, how we think about each other, and then the transience that all of those things define. If you believe any of the Lambda CDM models, the ultimate heat death of the universe, in the end, what remains is our brief spark of sentience and our deep yearning to shine a light in that darkness to say, I was here, I mattered. I answered some questions. I discovered something that no sentient being had ever known before. I added a small piece to the mosaic of human knowledge, and I made life better for those around me. That's the third question. And they're all intertwined. And why do I say that the questions don't change, but the answers do? Because the technology that enable us to explore those questions change. You know, the chemist Sir Humphry Davy said, nothing so much enlarges the native powers of people in different times and place than access to a new instrument. And as Steve Jobs said when reading an issue of Scientific American that I read about the same time, looking at the mode of efficiency of different organisms, the most efficient thing ever found among all species is a human on a bicycle in terms of energy efficiency. And a computer, it's a bicycle for the mind. And our opportunity in computing, as we think about those three intertwined questions, is to use computing to explore matter in the universe, to understand the biology that underpins life, and to think about how all of those frame our position in the universe. And as a bicycle for the mind, it's an incredible opportunity. And as that technology changes and the underlying instruments change, our ability to ask questions changes. And I think that democratizing power is real. It's why broad access to leading instrumentation is really important, because if it's limited, advantage accrues to the people who have the instruments, not the people who can ask the questions. And it's the best questions that in the end win. And that's why we want to empower as many minds as we can, because we want the best minds to ask and answer the best questions, because we all benefit from that.
I really like the bicycle metaphor because I actually just this weekend got on my bike and I went down the Encar Hill and it was so much fun. And it's fun in a very comparable way to, I don't know, getting immersed in code. So I really appreciate that. Your metaphor about kind of the mind and, computer, that reminds me of you have a lot of really funny things in your blog. I've been enjoying reading and it's probably going to take me a little while to finish it. You talk about a story, I think, where you visited Tibet and you were not prepared for the altitude. You said you saw like the oxygen tank in your room and you and your wife at first laughed, but then you got this terrible headache. And somewhere in that post, you said, "Unfortunately, I had no on and off switch, unlike my computer. However, as Commander Data once remarked on Star Trek: The Next Generation, if you had an on and off switch, would you tell anyone about it?" So, Dan, would you tell someone about your on and off switch? And if the answer is no, under what circumstances would you want to tell them about it?
I think everyone fears that their life opportunities are bounded. It's those questions that keep you going. And I think, yes, everyone fears an end. It's that longing to understand the future that drives us forward. The other part of that story, which you didn't tell, is in addition to having a oxygen debt from high altitude, that's when my computer died, because the aerodynamics of disks with flying heads, the air was too thin, and I lost the data on my disk. So I found myself struck down by the Navier-Stokes equations in a way that I had not expected.
That's very funny. And I remember reading that. So we're coming up on time. I have just one more question, and it's about friendship. You mentioned, I don't remember which blog post this was in, but you talked about just the hospitality and friendship that you experience. And just one of the great things about being an academic is that you have friends kind of all over the world. So I'm a very introverted person, and I'm social with the people that I work with, but I'm not very good at making friends. So, what advice can you give to kind of the introverted computer scientists out there that really want to have a lot of friends and want to be able to kind of travel and do these things? Is there an inflection point in life where that happens, or what have you done to kind of to get that kind of network?
Well, I'm an introverted myself. I think most people who are attracted to science and technology, there are exceptions, but the majority tend to be introverted. The one thing that I think unites us all is excitement about what we're doing. And one of the icebreakers that I have always found is to ask people to talk about what they're doing. And one of the great things about collaborating in computational science across so many disciplines is you get to approach it with a sense of naivete. And often I found myself asking questions that alternated between the sometimes grimace from an experienced expert in the field, thinking, oh, every undergraduate should know the answer to that, followed by a question that leads to a sigh that says, well, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be shortlisted for a Nobel Prize. No one knows the answer to that, and I can't tell the difference. That's part of the fun of the collaboration. But early in my career, it was mustering the courage to ask people, tell me about what you're doing. And the joy that dances on almost every scholar's face who begins to describe what they do, that's the thing that unites us. And that bridge is a mechanism for further conversations. The other thing I've learned traveling around the world is, yes, culture is different, languages differ, people are the same everywhere. They care about the same fundamental things. And the thing that unites us as scholars is that deep and abiding passion and curiosity. And if you touch that in another person, you've touched a kindred soul and you'll be friends for a lifetime.
Final question. So I know in your recent posts where you kind of announced your official retirement, but you'd still be doing a lot of things. What are you planning to do that isn't kind of directly work oriented? Not to say that you weren't enjoying things before, but what are your plans for this new phase of your life?
Well, first, I should say what I'm continuing to do. I am continuing to spend a lot of time on national science and technology policy at multiple levels, at multiple meetings today, in fact, about that. I continue to have a collaborative research project with my friends at Argonne and Northwestern looking at AI and edge-based sensors for environmental monitoring. And that scratches my science and technology itch. The other speaks to the policy piece. And then I have some consulting activities. But the things that I hope to do, I want to write a couple books. One perhaps about science and technology policy, one about the interesting experiences of becoming a scientist coming from a small town in a family whose parents scarcely managed to reach high school. But a lot of it is sharing experiences and talking to people. And then I have two hobbies that I engage, one of which I was fortunate to scratch in a big part of my professional life. I'm an amateur astronomer and I'm also a ham radio operator. And so those are ways to engage and share ideas in a different context. But the important thing is to not lose touch with the community because those are my friends, the ones I've spent a lifetime with, and that we have a lifetime of shared experiences.
That's really, really sweet. So, Dan, it has been such a pleasure chatting with you today. I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And I hope that we cross paths at some point and I get to meet you. I had so many questions for you today and I didn't get to answer them all, but I'm so grateful for your time today.
It's my pleasure to talk. As I said, that notion of continuity across scientific generations is really important. And all of us were young and we will all become old at some point, but the connections really matter. And it is a small world in the grand scheme of things. So although I've not met you, I know we have many connections from people from Todd Gamblin. You mentioned Ruth Marenshaw. I'm sure we could rattle off a dozen other people that we both work and know.
Absolutely.